This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
I'm interviewing Professor Carol Mundell, who works at Liverpool John Moores University, and she was giving a colloquium here at Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics entitled, excitingly, The Transient Explosive Universe. So, welcome. What's that all about, the transient explosive universe?
So I should be clear that it's not the universe itself that is transient or exploding. That's a different topic altogether. My colloquium actually is about the objects in the universe, some of the most violent explosions in the universe called gamma ray bursts. And these are powered by, we think, black holes that are formed either in the collapse of massive stars or the merger of two compact objects like neutron stars and black holes. And when the black hole is produced, there's an accretion disk and a relativistic jet, so an ultra-high-speed ejection of material. And when those jets of material point towards the Earth, we actually see a very bright flash of gamma rays.
Wow. So you began by telling us a bit about the history of these gamma ray bursts. It seems like they're still, in some ways, not that well understood. But when they were first discovered, you were saying they were a complete mystery.
That's right. They were discovered by the US military satellites, VALA satellites, that were monitoring the Earth, looking for violations of the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty in the late 60s, early 70s. And they said that the scientists who were in charge of the satellites actually found these flashes of high-energy gamma rays in their detectors. And I imagine for a short period of time there was some excitement or fear that somebody had violated the Test Ban Treaties. But very quickly they realized that these signals were actually extraterrestrial and they were coming from the sky. Now, at that time, the origin of these flashes was a complete mystery. And one of the reasons for that was that because the accuracy with which they could pinpoint where these flashes were coming from was very, very poor. So it wasn't possible to train other telescopes onto the locations of these flashes. And in some ways, this was why the field languished for many decades. Around the same time, pulsars were discovered, quasars were discovered. So these are fields that we know and love now, and they had 40 years worth, 50 years worth of research development. Gamma ray bursts, as they were termed at the time, really did languish a little bit until the early 90s when the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory was launched, and that had a gamma ray detector that was catching many of these flashes, and it showed that the flashes were coming from random positions on the sky. So the whole sky, it was isotropic, there was no preferred direction for these gamma ray flashes. They were not coming from the plane of our own Milky Way galaxy. And in fact, at that time, the debate really raged between whether they were very bright because they were nearby, so they were in the halo of our own Milky Way, or whether they were vast, luminous explosions at the edges of the universe. And in fact, scientists really began to think, well, maybe they're objects in our own Milky Way. And then sometime later, basically up into the 1990s, a Dutch-Italian satellite, Beppo Sachs, was launched. And this satellite really began to revolutionise the field because this provided the first X-ray detection, so-called afterglow, the dying embers of that gamma ray burst. And that was important because the X-ray afterglow was identified to a very accurate localization, so to arc-second precision. And really from then, the detection of that X-ray afterglow allowed optical astronomers to point their optical telescopes and find the corresponding optical transient counterpart to the gamma ray burst. That then allowed us to measure a redshift, which gave us a distance. And for the first time, it was then realized that these are cosmological objects and they're the most instantaneously luminous objects in the universe.
So you get the redshift from a spectrum, is it?
That's right. So once you find the optical transient, so a point source in your optical image that doesn't correspond to any known star, you then take a spectrum of that light and you can identify absorption lines. So where pieces of the light are missing, if you like, and they've been absorbed by material along the line of sight. And that gives you the identification of the redshift or the position along the line of sight, if you like, of where that object is rather than just the position on the sky.
So you're given a hint there by talking about various space observatories that these things were pretty difficult to detect. What is it about them that makes them so hard to detect? I mean, clearly you couldn't just have had a look with a normal sort of telescope and expected to pick up very much. What makes them different to the normal sorts of things that are looked at in astronomy, galaxies and stars and so on?
So they're completely unpredictable. I mean, we have no idea when one will go off and where it will go off. And so that unpredictability has really driven much of the technology development in the last 10 years. In particular, NASA launched a small mid-X mission called SWIFT, which is a dedicated gamma-ray burst satellite. And it combined all of the technology of the Compton Gamma-ray Observatory and BepoSats into one small rapid response satellite. So it has a gamma-ray detector, and when it finds and localizes a gamma-ray burst, it then sends that position both to the ground so that we can use our optical telescopes to look for the optical light, and it also tells its own X-ray telescope and its own ultraviolet optical telescope on board to slew very quickly to that gamma ray position. And this really opened up the era of rapid follow-up, and so we're now able to find these gamma ray bursts in real time. We have accurate localizations, and then we can use our telescopes both in space and on the ground to find the light from them, and then really use that light and the information encoded in that light to understand the physics of these objects.
And these gamma rays are very high frequency light, essentially. So is it the case that most of that doesn't get through our atmosphere, and
that's
you go
right
into space and you can see a lot more?
Exactly. I mean, fortunately for us, if the gamma rays did reach the surface of the Earth, we'd all be toasted. And so the Earth's atmosphere protects us from high energy rays, gamma rays, X-rays. I mean, obviously, you may have had an X-ray in a hospital. You'll have a lead plate that protects your organs from those high energy waves. The gamma rays are much higher energy than the X-rays, higher again.
How much energy is each sort of photon, each little packet of
gamma
rays?
So these energies, we measure them in electron volts, and they're giga electron volts, so, you know, billion electron volts of energy in one of these photons. So they're some of the highest energy photons you can detect. They're quite challenging to detect, but of course SWIFT has this nice technology, a so-called coded mask array, that allows the detection of these gamma rays, and also some identification of their localization. You can't focus them in the same way that you would an optical photon. So these are the very highest energy particle photons of light that we detect. The X-rays, again, are a little bit less energetic, and then we come right down into the optical and the radio.
And are gamma ray observatories looking out everywhere all the time? Is that how they capture these things when they go off?
So SWIFT can see some fraction of the sky. It can't see all of the sky at the same time. It's very difficult to design something that can see the whole of the sky and can also give you accurate localization. We also have the Fermi satellite, which is constantly scanning the sky and trying to pick up gamma ray bursts. So with the two missions together, SWIFT detects about 100 GRBs a year, and Fermi detects about 200 gamma ray bursts a year. But it's just the SWIFT mission that gives us the real-time accurate positions so that we can follow those up. But Fermi, of course, is revolutionising the study of the high-energy gamma rays from these gamma ray bursts.
So clearly from what you said, the follow-up is important. You're not just looking at those gamma rays and that's it. And that sort of ties into the work that you were talking about that you do at Liverpool John Moores. So how do you follow up the gamma ray bursts now?
So round about the same time as the SWIFT satellite was being developed, we were building a new kind of optical telescope. It's termed the Liverpool Telescope. It's not in Liverpool. It's on the mountaintop in the Canary Island of La Palma. And this is the world's fully autonomous robotic optical telescope. It's 2 meters in diameter, its mirror, so it's the largest of its kind. It slews very quickly, about 2 degrees a second, so it can get to any position in the sky when we trigger it, when we catch an alert from the gamma ray burst satellite. That goes immediately into the back of the telescope.
Without
any human intervention whatsoever. We have intelligent software, which we developed over many years because we knew that we're not going to be very intelligent in the middle of the night. And what actually happens is the satellite sends a signal down to the telescope, and it also sends a signal to our mobile phones. So our mobile phone buzzes and we wake up and we realise that as we're rubbing our eyes and gathering our wits, the telescope's already swung into action. It's stopped doing cleanly what it's doing, and it slews immediately to the position where the gamma ray burst is. And when we first started to develop this program, we were really taking photographs. So we were taking images of the location of where the gamma ray burst should be. And we developed quite a lot of intelligent software to try to figure out whether we'd found an optical transient in these photographs. The way we do this is we take 3 quick images in a red filter, and we extract all of the objects in the field. So we find all the stars, we measure their brightnesses and their positions, and we then compare those with catalogues of stars. And we say, yep, we know that one, we know that one. If we see something that is not in the catalogue, we then put that in a list of candidates, and we say, right, that's a new source. The next image is then treated exactly in the same way, and we then stick all our other candidates, and we actually start to build up light curves of things that we think might be candidates to the optical afterglow of the gamma ray burst. We do this for three images, and we do this very quickly, and we also compare the brightnesses of the new objects that we found to see if any of them are fading. And in that way, we're very efficient at finding optical counterparts to gamma ray bursts in real time. What we've since done is we've realised that actually by looking at how the light fades in the optical and also how its colour changes, that gives us a lot of physical information about the material and how it's being ejected in the explosion. But the one thing that it couldn't do was actually tell us about the magnetic fields. And we think, theoretically, magnetic fields are the key to understanding these huge explosions. And all of the predictions from the theories in terms of how the light faded were basically all the same. We couldn't distinguish between the models. And the one piece of observational information, if you like, or the new dimension we needed to open up, was to measure the polarization of the light. And so for that, we developed a new novel type kind of polarimeter, which allows us to measure the degree of polarization and its angle on the sky of the fading optical light in real time.
So you're looking at the direction of the wave, essentially, as it comes in. I don't mean the direction it's propagating, but the direction that it's waving in, if you like.
That's right, yeah. I mean, if you can think of an analogy. I mean, sunlight is not polarized, but if sunlight actually bounces off a shiny surface, so if it bounces off a lake, or you might think in terms of a wet road, if you're driving along and there's a wet road and the sun's shining from it, the glare that you get is actually polarized. And so the way you block that polarized glare out, you might have Polaroid sunglasses. And if you think of them almost being like slats that would allow the light to come through or to block it, those slats are aligned 90 degrees to the preferred plane of vibration of that polarized light, you'll block out the light. What our polarimeter does is we have one of those, if you think of the piece of Polaroid in your sunglasses, and we spin that 8 times a second, and we measure how much of the light comes through it as a function of angle around the 360 degrees. By doing that, we can actually measure the amount of polarization and the preferred angle.
Wow. So you were talking about the different types of gamma ray bursts that you see, and you were talking about short and long bursts. So if we imagine this thing is emitting all across the electromagnetic spectrum, how long does it take to do its emission at each sort of frequency, if you like?
So the distinction between short and long bursts came really observationally. So before we knew what gamma ray bursts were, and we were looking with the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory, people were studying how long the gamma ray flashes lasted and what kind of structure their light curves had. Did they have one flash? Did they have two flashes? How short and how long were these flashes? And when you plot the length of time the gamma ray flash lasts against how hard the spectrum is, so what this means is we measure how much energy comes out in a high energy band and how much energy comes out at a slightly lower energy, and we just take a ratio between those two numbers. And that tells us how, as I say, how energetic the burst is. So when we plot energy of the burst against time, we found that there were two distinct populations. There were the so-called short energetic bursts, and there were so-called longer, softer, less energetic bursts. And the division seemed to be around about 2 seconds. So the long gamma ray bursts are defined to last longer than 2 seconds. Now we know they can last for anything up to about 10,000 seconds, which is a huge amount of time for that amount of energy to be produced. This is in the observer's frame. The short bursts are defined to be less than 2 seconds, and some of them can be gone in tens of milliseconds. And the difference, we think, and this is something that, you know, we're obviously still investigating, but is a working hypothesis, is that the long gamma ray bursts are produced in the core collapse of a massive star. And we have some good evidence for that, because the small number of long bursts that have been found under a redshift of about half, we've been able to look at their light, and once the light from the gamma ray burst has faded away, after about 10 or 15 days, the light brightens a little bit. There's a little bump or a hump in the light curve. And when you take a spectrum of that light, it looks like a supernova. So we got a direct connection between a gamma ray burst and a supernova.
Is it a supernova that you say it's the core collapse, or is that a supernova where we can just see the gamma rays, or is it a different kind of phenomenon?
Well, we think it's both. All supernovae don't produce gamma ray bursts, but we think that long gamma ray bursts are accompanied by a supernova explosion. The light from the supernova, obviously the peak of that light is maybe 10, 20, 30 days after the explosion. That's the synthesis of nickel and other elements. The gamma ray burst itself, the very bright light from the jet, we see at very early time. And once that has faded away, we're then able, because we have the contrast then, to be able to see both the host galaxy it lives in and the supernova component. And it was really measuring the spectrum of that light and finding that it had all the features of a slightly obscure supernova type 1bc that allowed us to directly connect massive star collapse with gamma ray bursts. The short gamma ray bursts are very different. The idea for those is that they're the merger of two compact objects, so a neutron star with a black hole or two black holes. And they have much shorter flashes of gamma rays, and they're much fainter in the optical, and they're actually much more challenging to find. So that, again, is still an area where we're working very hard to understand. We think that they're important because they may produce gravitational waves.
Are they rarer than the longer bursts?
They are rarer in the sense of how we detect them, because the SWIFT satellite is very sensitive to the long gamma ray bursts because of the way their different energy bands detect the gamma rays. The shorter bursts are harder and therefore are much more challenging to detect with SWIFT, and so there are many fewer of those that have been detected with SWIFT. But we know from previous studies with the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory that there should be more short bursts than SWIFT sees. And in fact, the Fermi satellite is finding many more of those short bursts. The real challenge still remains in finding the short bursts and delivering an accurate localization.
So you talked about the redshift being up to about a half. So that would mean looking back up to about 5 billion years into the universe's past. So they're obviously incredibly, incredibly bright. And then you talked about beaming as well. So how do those two things
fit? So redshift of a half is we class as the nearby ones.
I see.
The highest redshift gamma ray burst that has been spectroscopically confirmed is at redshift of 8.2, when the universe was only 600,000 years old. We also have one that's been photometrically identified, so it doesn't have a spectrum but just has colour information out to a redshift of 9.4. So they are also the most distant objects in the universe. So you're right, they're incredibly luminous, very, very bright. So we're interested in them both in terms of the physics of the objects themselves, because they're extremes in every way, strong gravity, large magnetic fields, very high ejection speeds. But they also act as remarkable beacons, and they shine across the entire universe. So if you find a burst at redshift of 8.2, it illuminates all of that material in a pencil beam along the line of sight from 600,000 years ago to now. And so they're actually remarkable lighthouses, really, for the distant universe.
And why do they beam? Do we have any idea?
So again, I think this goes back to the magnetic fields. And we think the magnetic fields are fundamental to helping to focus and collimate and accelerate the material in a small pencil beam, if you like. The so-called fireball model of gamma ray bursts describes that because the expansion is so quick, I mean, the material is moving close to the speed of light itself, we then have effects that are caused by special relativity where the light is beamed or focused into a narrow opening angle. And obviously, when that beam points towards the Earth, we then see it as a gamma ray burst.
Wow. And then when you spoke about gravitational waves as well being produced, does that mean that you could sync up with gravitational wave detectors and maybe there could be a burst that would trigger both things?
That's what we're hoping very much to do as the gravitational wave detectors come online in the next few years, and towards 2018 and ultimately 2022. Obviously, that's, you know, the big holy grail in that area is to find a gravitational wave. Again, it's like gamma ray burst science was in the 1960s and 70s. We won't have a very good accurate localization. And so the big challenge then is to search the large patch of sky from which we think we've detected the gravitational wave and try to associate that with a particular source. And that really is a challenge, because we're looking across vast areas of the sky. There are lots of optical sources within a particular patch that the gravitational wave might be identified from. And so the real challenge for us is to try to figure out where the needle in that haystack is.
Mm. And then when you talked about, was it the redshift of sort of 8 or even 9, and you were saying that's only hundreds of thousands of years after the Big Bang, is that enough time for something so energetic to develop that then causes a gamma ray burst? I sort of imagined a few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang, well, there are atoms, but not much else.
Well, we think there are stars, obviously. The stars, you know, the first generation of population 3 stars lit the universe up. Obviously, these stars that produce the gamma ray bursts, we think, are 200 to 300 solar masses. So these massive stars, they live fast, they die hard. Mm. You know, we still don't yet know whether population 3 stars can produce a gamma ray burst. But when the redshift 8.2 burst was discovered, when you actually compare the gamma ray light curves, the gamma ray properties of the small number of gamma ray bursts that we found in a redshift above 6. They all look remarkably similar. So the physics of producing those high-speed jets is obviously common right out to at least 600,000 years after the Big Bang. And the real question then is, what are the physics of the population 3 stars, that first generation of stars that lit up the universe? But we know that we have supermassive black holes at the centres of all bulge-dominated galaxies in the universe. So the idea is that there should have been some seed black holes in the early universe that then would have grown to produce today's supermassive black holes. So it may be that gamma ray bursts are the key for that too.
And the population 3 stars then, they're the ones that are sort of almost entirely hydrogen and helium. And do we think theoretically they can become extremely massive and therefore burn out very, very quickly?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the ideas behind them. And the question is whether they would be able to produce all of the features that we see in a gamma ray burst.
And would that sort of link together perhaps the reasons why black holes in the centres of galaxies tend to grow concordantly with the growth of the galaxies themselves?
Well, again, I mean, theoretically, you have to have a seed black hole. The question really is, what is the mass spectrum of those seed black holes? How massive do they have to be? Are you talking a few solar masses? Do they have to be 100? Do they have to be 1,000 times the mass of our sun? And so there are various theories that describe how these seed black holes then grow into supermassive black holes. But I think the jury's still out on what produces the seeds in the first place.
And could we expect any gamma ray burst to happen really close to us? Have you been able to ascertain a rate at which they might be happening?
So it depends how nearby, when we talk about how whether a gamma ray burst could happen in the local universe. Until now, we've thought it's very unlikely that one could happen in our own Milky Way, because there's a tendency to see gamma ray bursts, long gamma ray bursts, happening in small dwarf galaxies with normal star formation regions, but that actually have low metallicity. So the idea is that in order to have these massive stars, probably Wolf-Rayet stars that spin at a high speed before they collapse, that they would actually be low metallicity objects. And the idea for the Milky Way is that the metallicity is, it's an enriched galaxy, so the metallicity is probably too high to produce a gamma ray burst. So I think we're hopefully safe from being turned into crisps. But I think in terms of thinking about up to redshift 10, for gamma ray burst scientists, of course, under redshift of 1 is considered to be relatively local. And until recently, any of the gamma ray bursts that we found that we were studying for associated supernova, and I mentioned those earlier, they were all sub-energetic events. So typical energies of a gamma ray burst, isotropic equivalent gamma ray energy of up to 10 to the 54 ergs, maybe 10 to the 51 when you try to focus it into a beam. The sub-energetic ones were around about 10 to the 48, 10 to the 47. So sub-energetic explosions. Recently, in fact, last year, last April, we found a gamma ray burst at redshift of only 0.3. And this looked like a classical long gamma ray burst. It was the highest gamma ray fluence ever detected. It looked very classically like a very bright optical afterglow. Everything pointed to the fact that it was a normal long gamma ray burst. So this is the closest long gamma ray burst that we've yet discovered. So, you know, I think we're having to revise our ideas of the populations of long gamma ray bursts and their redshift distributions.
So when you were looking into the future on your talk, then it seemed as though there would be an increasing number of observatories and instruments that were designed to pick things up quickly, or what you called the time domain universe. So not just looking at something that's there all the time, but finding things that come and go. So how's that going to work in the future? I mean, you've already told us about the kind of alerts that you get, the automatic movement of the Liverpool telescope. And in perhaps a decade, there's going to be the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, which is going to aim to be surveying the sky sort of every couple of weeks. So will those things all link together into a sort of new kind of observatory?
Yeah, I think the future for time domain astronomy is very exciting. Until recently, obviously, people who studied gamma ray bursts were, although it was a very active international community, a relatively niche subject. You needed special technology to catch these flashes. Obviously, people who study supernovae have always been interested. Amateur astronomers have always been very good at finding new transient sources like novae or supernovae on the sky. Professional astronomers have started to develop those sorts of facilities. For example, the Palomar Transient Factory that Caltech lead. That's a very good supernova machine for finding new kinds of supernovae and large numbers of supernovae. I think in the next few years, and you know, the next decade, the whole area of transient astronomy will, well, to use a euphemism, will explode. We will have the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, which will give us something like 2 million transient alerts a night.
Oh, you'll get a text message for each one of those.
Well, I'm hoping not. I'm going to have to design some software that will filter many of those out and decide literally what is important scientifically for me to follow up with my facilities. The Gaia satellite launched last year in December. That should start to produce transient alerts in the autumn, and obviously we'll be following those up. We also have this new discovery of radio sources, the so-called fast radio bursts, which are millisecond flashes of radio emission from the sky. Nobody, again, knows what they are. The origin of these fast radio bursts is completely unknown.
They don't tie with the gamma ray bursts at all, or is that not something that we can tell yet?
Not yet. There hasn't been a coincidence. There certainly hasn't been one that has been found at any other wavelength. They're very challenging to follow up because obviously they're gone in a few milliseconds. But there are many attempts now. I mean, radio astronomers are beginning to survey the sky seriously to look for these things. There are 5 known to date. And obviously my team are very interested in following these up in the optical. We have the Liverpool telescope. We also have a copy of the Liverpool telescope in Hawaii and Australia, the Falks telescopes. These are now owned by Las Cumbres Observatory in California, and they have also built a network of 9 1-meter telescopes. So this is called the Las Cumbres Observatory Global Telescope Network. So my team will be using that network in conjunction with the Liverpool telescope to follow up fast radio bursts, gamma ray bursts, and any of the transient alerts that we will get from Gaia, which might signal a star being disrupted around a supermassive black hole at the centre of a galaxy, for example. So I think it's a very exciting time that we're entering. We have developed some expertise, obviously, in following gamma ray bursts up, and we're now starting to think in a much bigger global way as to how to follow up all these different kind of new alerts that we get, and also to look for new ones. Obviously, the LSST and the Liverpool telescope itself has little wide field cameras bolted to the outside of the telescope that we're using as a pilot project or a pathfinder for LSST. So we're actually trying to actually characterize the transient sky and say, well, how does the sky change in a night? How many objects do change, and how do they change their brightness, and what's the nature of them? And we have something like 900 million observations of 21 million objects so far just in our database, just for free.
So. Wow. It's maybe worth thinking about just how extreme these events are that you're talking about seeing. I mean, it's sort of like science fiction, really. You're talking about things like stars actually being sucked wholesale into black holes.
Yeah, so once material falls over the event horizon, if the event horizon exists, then obviously that material is lost. Any information about the material is lost. Light can't escape from the event horizon of a black hole. The material that we're thinking about is stuff that gets close to the black hole, and obviously the tidal forces then become very large, potentially producing a flare from this material. And we actually know that this can happen because there's a gas cloud that's being disrupted and potentially torn apart by the black hole at the centre of our own Milky Way. And there are telescopes all across the world and satellites above the Earth that are staring at the centre of our own galaxy, looking and waiting for this kind of flare that might be produced when this gas cloud is disrupted over about the next 9 to 10 months.
Wow. Well, maybe a last thing I thought I might ask you about the instruments. You already talked about them a little bit, like the polarimeter on the Liverpool telescope. So this was, I don't know if this is a Beatles reference, I guess it is. It was called Ringo. Is that a Liverpool connection?
I would love to claim that the name of Ringo came to us in a moment of inspiration about the Beatles. Unfortunately, it didn't. It was actually because the first generation of our Ringo detector produced rings. We actually glued our polarizer to a deviating prism and we spun it at 550 revs per minute. And as the light comes through that optical system, it's literally spread out in a ring, and that ring is then recorded onto the CCD. So all of our images consisted of rings instead of spots. So a star was spread out as a ring, a GRB afterglow was spread out as a ring. And if the light was polarized, then that ring would have a lumpy appearance. It would have 2 bright spots and 2 dim spots. And by measuring the profile of the light around that ring, we'd be able to extract the information on the polarization. Since then, we've upgraded Ringo into Ringo 2, where we took the deviating prism away and we just spin the Polaroid. This time we slowed it down, so it only spun 8 times a second, but we put a new kind of CCD detector on the back, so-called electron multiplying CCD, which reads out very quickly and it has no readout noise. So we're able to take an image every 1/8 of a second, and then we can stack those images and process them in a way that maximises the signal and allows us to reconstruct that polarisation signal that we used to have for Ringo. Right. We now have Ringo 3, which is a new generation where we now have, it's equivalent to three Ringo 2s looking in three different colours. So we have simultaneous multicolour photographs as well as three bands measuring polarisation.
And that's all helping you to try and determine more about the physics of the objects.
Then. That's right. I mean, the ultimate goal is to try to connect the physical properties of the exploding material, the expanding material that's being shocked as it travels out, with the structure of the magnetic field. And there's no other way to probe that magnetic field, because these things are so far away, they'll always look like point sources. So we won't have beautiful images of jets. We actually have to try to disentangle the physical geometry and the structure of the magnetic fields from the temporal behaviour of that polarised light and how it changes with colour.
And are they quite novel instruments that you're using, or are you sort of putting together other ideas that have never been used for this purpose before?
So these are completely novel. They're actually the world's only rapid response polarimeters. I mean, other people are designing and developing things at the moment, but when Ringo first went on Sky, it was the only way of actually doing something like this, because we didn't beforehand know what the property of the light would be. And traditional polarimeters work by measuring the intensity of the light at a particular angle, and then a little bit later measuring the intensity of the light at a different angle and comparing how that changes. Now, that's fine when the brightness of the light is constant and any change in brightness is as a function of angle is caused by polarization. But of course, for our gamma ray bursts, we didn't know whether we knew the light would be fading, and we didn't know a priori whether the polarization would be changing too. So we had to have an instrument that would do that very, very quickly, rather than waiting for a few minutes and, you know, measuring the light at a different angle. And so we had to use quite a novel design. This was based on a small stellar polarimeter that Dave Clark in Glasgow, University of Glasgow, had first postulated in the literature. So we went and had a chat with him and figured out how to build his design and make it into a professional instrument for a professional telescope.
That's great. Well, it sounds like there's a lot ahead for the whole transient field, and I assume the more data there is, the more work it's going to give to theoretical physicists to try and understand what's going on in these systems.
Indeed, we're already, I think, pushing theorists to think a little bit differently. In December, we published a paper in Nature with the first measurement of the evolution of polarisation as a function of time. Previously, all the measurements had been single shot, so we could tell you it's polarised or it's not polarised. And we made the first measurement of the evolution of polarisation. We found incredibly high polarisation. It began at about 30% and declined to 16% over about 10 minutes. The position angle was relatively constant. I mean, it didn't change. Only changed by a maximum of 15 degrees over those 10 minutes. So that already ruled out a number of favourite theories. And so hopefully we're pushing the boundaries of the theorists and helping them to think differently about their models.
Fabulous. Well, thank you very, very much for giving us this interview.